She is a poet, and she believes in the power of words. So when in the course of the conversation ahead, she says one simple word, it echoes throughout everything she'll be telling us about her new novel, An Impossibility of Crows. She says, flight, F-L-I-G-H-T. Flight, of course, refers to the act of flying, but thinking more deeply, it can also refer, for example, to an instance of imaginative thinking or dreaming, a flight of fancy, a flight of the imagination. And that's so important for us today as we speak with her. So, in summoning to mind these many senses of flight as she explored the landscape where she was shaped here in Pennsylvania, Kirsten Kashuk surely considered those who flew. Perhaps Amelia Earhart and Wilbur and Orville, maybe Leonardo, who brought art, science, and technology together, a practice Kirsten revels in. But she digs even deeper into the human collective memory and lands in ancient Greece and the myth of Daedalus and Icarus, which, as we're told in common lit, may have roots even earlier in the Bronze Age Minoan civilization in Crete. And speaking of Crete, Daedalus appears in the Iliad as the architect who built a dancing floor, for Princess Ariadne in Crete. We'll soon understand why Kirsten might smile at that little echo. And she opens up a key notion in this story when she tells an interviewer, Frankenstein is one inspiration to the book, but there's also the myth of Icarus and Daedalus. In Greek mythology, Daedalus was the architect of the Minotaur's labyrinth, but he also made wings to escape the island of Crete, where he and his son Icarus were imprisoned. So if Agnes, the main character here in the story, is building a crow, she's building the crow so somebody can fly away, right? And so the novel had to have something to escape. It's the logic of myth. Daedalus gave the wings to his son Icarus, so she's going to give the crow to her daughter Mina. But why does Mina need the crow? And so that was the seed of the idea that Agnes would see her daughter in this way, as needing saving, that her daughter was lacking because her mobility was compromised. But Mina doesn't see herself that way, and her father doesn't see her that way. But that is how Agnes sees her, as needing rescue, even though Agnes clearly needs more help than her daughter does. In Agnes's twisted logic, Mina provides a reason for breeding the crow, who is named Solo. What Agnes thinks is an act of love is just wrong-headed. By the end, she may have learned that, though I'm not entirely sure. Words of award-winning writer Kirsten Kashuk. Kashuk is a Pew Fellow in the Arts, a poet and novelist who has a background in dance. She's the author of a number of books of poetry and a chapbook, and her second novel, An Impossibility of Crows, has just been issued by the University of Massachusetts Press. Kirsten Kashuk has recently moved to northeastern Pennsylvania, where she teaches at the University of Scranton and at Marywood. As we'll come to understand, there could be no more appropriate place for a book launch than the Bird Gallery of the Everhart Museum in Scranton, and she will offer a talk in that gallery tomorrow at 5 without charge for An Impossibility of Crows. Kirsten Kashuk paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about her creative life and her novel, and while being surrounded by birds at the Everhart Museum will be perfect. Even so, we had our conversation in the WVIA production studio, surrounded by 1,000 or so 33 and a third LPs, a format Kirsten loves. We're sitting here in WVIA's large LP library, and when I read about your background in dance, I wondered what music has meant to you along the way.
So I am a writer, and I was trained as a dancer. But I always have said that if I had talents for music, especially singing, I would have done that in between. So you definitely picked up on that. Yes, with dance, you get such an exposure to such a wide variety of music from childhood on, classical, but also jazz, and even really contemporary experimental work when I got into modern dance in college.
And we can think about dancers like Merce Cunningham, who didn't use music at all in some of his dancing.
Absolutely. John Cage and has an amazing book, Silence, and there's a piece, I can't remember how many minutes, four minutes and 38 seconds, I think, of just silence, and Merce Cunningham choreographed work to that.
We know how important language is to you, and we'll talk about that as we get into your novel, but with dance, we know that gesture and the body movements, that's a language too.
Absolutely. Yes, I think people say, what is the relationship between your writing and your dance? And I often process things first through movement when I'm not able to access them or articulate them in words. And through that process, it's much easier for me to write afterwards.
What about little Kirsten? Were you doing Nutcracker and taking ballet lessons and things like that?
Absolutely. Siblings. I have an older brother who danced with David Parsons Dance Company. My younger sister danced with the Joffrey Ballet and then Hubbard Street Dance Company and was director of the Juilliard briefly, the dance program there. And my little brother also danced in Chicago and Seattle. So our whole family danced. My older sister did not become a professional dancer, but she ran marathons, so she's very big on the body as well.
Teachers and artists like you might be worried with young people on devices so much of the time that they aren't bringing mind, body, spirit together.
Yes, the mind-body split, absolutely. My students often, we talk about how writers often believe that they exist from the neck up and the wrist down. And even in my intro to creative writing, I have them do breath exercises and move a little bit and stand up because your posture and the way that you engage with your body absolutely has an effect on how you write. And it's rhythmic. I tell students to go for walks because the walking and to think through the things they want to write while they're walking, because it will give them a natural cadence that their language will engage with after they've done that. For poetry especially, I think people don't even realize that all our language is in rhythm. We just don't attend to it.
And so your parents would have been thrilled then.
My parents were neither writers nor dancers, but they were such supportive people of the arts in general. And my father loved poetry. So poetry comes and writing comes from my childhood. He would recite the Jabberwocky to us almost every night. And we all memorized it with a Cockney accent, actually.
Did you?
A bad Cockney accent. Well,
and again, those are words, they're close to maybe we can understand 'twas brillig, but it's got that wonderful rhythm and sound, right?
And all the words are etymologically linked to words that we do know. And so we supply meaning, even though it's not there, that is actually quite close to what we could imagine that he meant by that language, which I love.
So simultaneously you studied each?
I bounced back and forth between studying dance. I mean, I studied dance and writing all the way through college, but I didn't major at Yale. I majored in English literature. And then I went on right after that, actually, to get an MFA in dance from the University of Iowa, which is known for its writing.
Isn't that something?
And I attended a ton of readings there, and it did encourage me to go back and continue with my writing.
Initially, when you were going back to your writing in this way, what was the reward initially for you when you were working with words in that way? What did you find there that maybe you weren't quite so satisfied or finding with the dance?
I had more control over language than I ever did of my body. I I choreographed. I love to choreograph. But of course, that's a very collaborative meaning-making enterprise where you put the material in front of your collaborative dancers and they give back to you things you could not even imagine. Although that is an amazing experience, I also had a little bit of a control issue about needing everything to be as I wanted it. And you could do that in writing. Now later, it's come full circle, and I love doing collaborative writing and editing with people. But yes, at the beginning, I think the ability to be able to say exactly what I wanted to say and then go back and be a bit of a perfectionist about it without dealing with other sensibilities was appealing.
And we find in your most recent novel that you care about words and their meaning, and you just used the word etymologically when you were talking about Lewis Carroll. And that means you explore words. A poet would want to have words that have resonance, not just the declarative meaning. So that would be a natural for a poet to explore those levels.
Absolutely. I think it was Emerson who said that every word is a fossil. So when you dig at it, there is an entire cultural milieu that comes up. I just learned yesterday that the word tall comes from an old English word that meant fast. And I still haven't figured that out. How tall? Maybe long-legged people move quicker? I have no idea, but it was a very interesting history.
That's it. And so, maybe somewhere down the line.
Yeah. Yes, I will write about it.
So poetry was the entrance?
Poetry. In second grade, I think everyone is encouraged to write a haiku. And my teacher very much liked it and hung it in the hallway. This is a story. When did I know that I wanted to be a poet? I knew it when the guidance counselor pulled me out of class and gushed to me about my poem and started to cry. I later learned she was going through a divorce at that time. But the impact of moving someone as a 7-year-old, moving an adult, was I can't express how much that meant.
And in your time as an artist, whether you're dancing or you're writing, the world must have changed. And the need for the arts as you see it, even more so or the same as always? Or how do you assess what it is you're doing in light of what's happening around us?
I think there's an urgency to reimagining what is possible. And I feel that artists are uniquely equipped to do that. It was Ursula Le Guin who said that she's a science fiction writer and said, we need the people who can imagine a new future that is different than the one we're experiencing now. I think she said, we imagine that capitalism is, you know, inescapable, but she said, so was the divine right of kings, which I love that quote.
And that gives us a good way into your novel about imagining what's possible. Mm-hmm. And you use in the title an impossibility of crows, but impossibility is a word that's used scientifically, right?
Yes. My husband is a scientist, and it's wonderful to write science fiction or things on the edge of science fiction because I always have a reference in the house, which is really nice. But the idea of impossibility, we were just talking about it in a positive light, but there's always also the idea of imagining and just going forward with technology that can go wrong. And I'm thinking about AI right now and us charging into the field and not understanding the ramifications of it, even though some of it, and my husband would tell us, the work that it's made possible in genetics especially has been wonderful and will help people, but we don't know all the ramifications.
And sometimes dystopian fiction then can help us in that, where we see how things might play out and oops.
Absolutely.
Did you read science fiction when you were a little one, or when did you come to that as a reader?
I did. I think I've always been attuned to language. So I didn't read a lot of pulp fiction growing up, but I read a ton of classics. And so I read Ray Bradbury and Asimov and Ursula Le Guin and Margaret Atwood as I was growing up, and especially the women. And then when I discovered Octavia Butler, it was transformative. Those women especially talked about the social ramifications of technology in a way that not all the men were as talented at ferreting out.
When you write a book like this that is so powerful, is it a hope that we have an experience of slowly, as you draw us in and we begin to think about what the implications of the story are and where you're taking us, that we might somehow, by the time we close the book, have some sense of opening up a bit?
I hope so. Writing is always a process of opening for me. So I think I began the book with a feeling of isolation, and I think that continues throughout the book in some ways. But when you write about a place, and this is written about South Central Pennsylvania, so down 81, the place, it was open to me. I was doing research about it and found a ton of information about the area that I was raised in that I had no understanding of, that wasn't taught us in our history books. And I certainly had hints about maybe in graduate school, but it was actually going to Ephrata and picking up old pamphlets and materials and going into local archives that was really eye-opening about what the area, maybe the more unpleasant aspects of the history.
And the sense we have, too, is that the place has held on to the soil, the buildings, the whole topography has been affected by what's taken place there generation after generation. And so as the sediment might be building in a river or coming down a mountain and the layers are building up, there's some sort of energy, would you call it?
I would. I believe in that. I'm not sure I believe in traditional haunting, but I believe that energy inheres in place. When I was younger, I thought I was going to study Japanese literature when I was an undergrad, and I did take a lot of classes, and I studied the Shinto religion, which very much is about there are spirits and deities that are attached to places and objects in the environment, even like large stones and waterfalls, and it made sense to me. It also reminded me of my Irish background on today, which also the Gaelic belief in how the environment they are in holds energies and spirit.
That's right. The veil gets thin in October, right? And what you do so well is you help us experience it in a way that if we aren't inclined to believe the land holds generations of energies, you open us at least to the possibility and the way it affects the people in the story. By the time we get to the end, we say, well, what if? And you're also talking about Gettysburg, where there was so much carnage and violence, right?
Yes, and I really did. I spent, when you grow up near Gettysburg, you go on field trips there a lot. And so I experienced that place over time, over years of my own as a child. And then I brought my own children there and seeing it through their eyes and going through the tour and hearing those stories again, maybe 15, 20 years later from the last time, I realized how much it had impacted my understanding of where I grew up, but also the country I grew up in.
Now, what do you say to people who ask you, well, what's your book about? So that you don't predispose them to have an idea that will spoil their coming at it fully open. How do you talk about it?
It does have an actually pretty easy elevator pitch, which is, ex-chemist returns to her family farm to build a crow the size of a horse. People are usually interested. So.
It's clear that you have immersed yourself in crowness.
I have. I always love them. And that's another poetry thing. One of the first poems I ever loved was Wallace Stevens' 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And even though that's not specifically about crows, I think it is. And the really compressed imagery of that poem played into how crows function so differently in different myths, people's personal mythologies. I mean, you go down to Jim Thorpe and you can buy little crow's feet on necklaces. It is, it's very much a Gothic standby, and there is a ton of literature about crows, and scientifically they're fascinating. They are so smart and they can do so much. They can literally solve problems that are 4 and 5 step problems at least. So it is, it's kind of shocking when somebody is like, but your crow talks, that's not real. I'm like, it is though. Actually, crows talk.
And one of the things before I opened the mm-hmm. book, what came to mind was Van Gogh and his wheat fields and the crows. And everybody says, oh, it was an omen. But if you read, and you probably have done so, people say, no, no, it was about his sense of wanting to be free.
Flight. Crows are often talked of in certain cultures as messengers between the living and the dead. And that has its dark side, but it also has that idea of them being freed from normal constrictions of even other birds. That they can fly, but they can transcend the veil, as you said.
And so some of the things that I noticed were names, like Agnes, which is a name that you probably explored and chose because you wouldn't choose a name lightly, so purity in its roots. Kron sounds like crow and Kron, but it also, in German, crane, right? A bird. So there's that that you give us with Agnes Kron. And then, of course, the Kron being in that neck of the woods with the Pennsylvania-German connections. And then Mina, Bram Stoker.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We don't have to know those things. But again, it gives us that valence, that resonance, right?
I hope so. I definitely... I love books that have layers. So somebody, a teacher, told me, you know, what should I write? Write something you would like to read. And so I always have those, I guess my kids would call them Easter eggs, where if you dig down into some of the details, you'll find that there are subversive ideas, Mina being an example of a relationship to Dracula, but also... you were noticing the bird references. Another corvid, which is what a crow is a mina bird, spelled differently, but also that relationship.
You don't hesitate to give us some of the other names for crow groupings, and it doesn't become a lesson from Wikipedia. You have such a flair for keeping the narrative going that it just enhances our experience.
I've read enough science fiction that drops a little too much information, so... pull back a bit.
And that's another beauty of your writing, and that's your sensitivity to how much to expose and bring us in to as we go along. We're drawn along, you give us more. It could be incidental, you're not hitting us over the head such as bad science fiction might do, but you're building and building and building the tension and making a reference here, and then suddenly pages down the line, oh... so that means you're a good mystery writer, right?
This is my first mystery, so thank you, and I hope so. I would love to. I love mysteries. Who doesn't love mysteries? I'd love to write another.
Well, I hope you will, because you really do have a knack. And here you're bringing us a former scientist and a crow as big as a horse, and the crow is named Solo. Why would you... explore in this instance a scientist? You're married to a scientist. You're an artist. What about the tension between art and science that you work on through this narration?
That was a real pleasure. My husband is a scientist. I am a writer. And in this book, Agnes, who is the voice you hear most often, is a scientist. So I was putting on those shoes, which was, it was fun. There's darkness in the book, but there's also humor. And I got to poke fun at the husband, Bruce, in this. He's a poet, and I got to have Agnes throw a couple digs his way that I think are not unfair about poets and their self-importance and their internality, for lack of a better word. Scientists and writers are very similar in a lot of ways, but they... in my experience, they don't recognize the similarities necessarily. And it was fun to sort of show that by flipping the genders in this one.
And so the family is there, and moving into a house that was in the family. So there are maybe not literally ghosts, but there are waiters from Pop Ort there that have been moldering on the porch, and Ruth is mom. And so there are these relationships with people who have been gone, but we all know those relationships continue.
They do. And I'm not sure when I started writing that I knew that Ruth, who is Agnes's mom, would be so full a character. But she discovers her journals. And as soon as I wrote that, I realized what an interesting gift it would be to learn about someone you lost in a fuller way than you probably had the chance to when they were alive. But it's not a conversation because Ruth isn't there. So there's sadness to it, but there's also this growing knowledge and maybe more sympathy than Agnes had towards her mom when she started the journey.
And at the same time, Agnes is a mother, and she is trying to make sure that Mina is not going to be constrained the way generations of women have been in this family or elsewhere.
Yes. Agnes's relationship to her own daughter is difficult, and I will just say wrongheaded. She does not appreciate her daughter for all the gifts that her daughter has and focuses on her physical limitations. And it's funny. I think a lot of people see the Frankenstein relationship, a mad scientist building a monster and this horse crow. But I think often of Daedalus and Icarus, which is the inventor in Greek mythology who created wings to fly away from an island prison. And he gave a pair to his son who could not follow instructions. Probably, I always said, Icarus is an artist. He couldn't follow the instructions as writ.
It's so important that people start out and just get drawn along with you because you do have that sense of momentum. And that doesn't mean rushing. It just means building, I would think, maybe. And as the tension goes. Again, when we were talking earlier about dance and the body, that's really important. And when you were describing, and we won't say under what circumstances, Mina and her body in a position which is not on level ground and so forth, you just have a beautiful way of understanding the anatomy of what that might look like, what that might be like.
Yeah, she was an interesting character. She doesn't speak much because when you meet Agnes at the beginning of the novel, her husband has already taken Mina. He's had enough. And so you get most of the information through flashbacks. But it was important to me that even though Agnes couldn't see Mina fully, that I somehow communicated to the audience that she was a fully fleshed out person. And that you can tell that Agnes is wrong. She's a faulty narrator in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways.
And so the thoughts that we have in terms of mothers and daughters and Ruth and Agnes and Mina, and we meet a sister,
Bethany, yes,
and her daughter, and the sense of having those relationships, but they were hatched in this place, which is toxic, right?
That is it. Agnes has a problem making anything good, and she blames herself. But I blame what's coming up through the soil. So that's an interesting tension, and I love it when readers get angry at Agnes because then I know that they care, but I still have a lot of sympathy. I spent a lot of years with Agnes. I understand her thinking a little bit more on how she struggles.
And you give us a way in through the journaling, and that works so well.
Thank you. I never kept a regular journal, but I have kept many journals over the years, and I find journal writing fascinating. I will I will always go to the library and pick up the letters and journals of writers. One of the most amazing ones that I have is the incidental writings of Louise Bourgeois, the artist. She's fantastic. And the way she sees the world, it's not just in her drawings and her sculptures. It is evident in her language as well. And also the fact that French was her native language. So there's always this inter-language punning that is going on in her speaking, and all of those really idiosyncratic ways of expressing yourself that don't come out in anything other than journals are wonderful.
Well, it shows. We think about grotesque. Often grotesque is larger, out of proportion, so that becomes something that might be grotesque. But you use the word sublime, and I wonder what that term means to you in this connection.
The sublime. I like the description by the philosopher Immanuel Kant, who likens it to something that is too hard to comprehend. And so we have to, like infinity or the ocean, something, or standing on the edge of an incredibly tall mountain that is beyond our comprehension. And yet, it was very important to him that humans try to comprehend it. They try to wrap their head around it. And so what that creates is movement. It creates this sort of macro, micro, back and forth, trying to wrap your head around something that you absolutely cannot. And for me, that is Solo the bird, and it's the history of the place. And yeah, that's sublime.
I would, if there's a place that you think you might read for us.
Yes, I can read the very first page or two. August 29th. Solo I bred for my daughter, Mina. I thought I'd give her wings, and now I'm not sure what I was thinking. Bruce has just this week filed for divorce. I got papers. After my dad died old, he had me old, and of hatred, I returned to our farm in Latourte. My husband and daughter came with. There were questions. I can't blame Bruce. If I were him, I would have left me. But he took Mina with him. Of course he did. I still have questions. Would Solo have let Mina ride him? Given his mass, will he be able to lift himself into the air at all? And if yes, will he want to be flown? To be ridden with girlhood? God knows I never wanted that. But can a bird be said to want anything? Can a girl? Questions persist. I'm no biologist. I was a chemist before, but this is all new to me, a new way of thinking. Crows are never inert. They're labile, reactive. They shift. Except their eyes. Their eyes are maybe a little bit dead. Bruce and Mina left in winter. This spring came and went like a sad song. It's almost September. I've been spending a good deal of time alone with the crow. It's been a summer of solo. Solo and summer and me, the barn like an oven. Me and my blackbird baked in a pie. Solo hot, he says. Yes, I say. I have of late been finding it advisable to respond to my experiment.
Thank you very much. Now, what's so exciting is that you will be reading in the Everhart Museum's Bird Gallery.
I will, with 700 specimens of taxidermied birds.
How did that come about?
Oh, it's amazing. Scranton has been the most wonderfully welcoming community. I've moved around quite a bit, and I cannot speak enough about the people here. So my neighbor is Judge Alice Greystone, and she heard that I had this novel and said, you need to go talk to Tim Holmes at the Everhart Museum. You need to launch your book there. And I went, and I agreed with her. It was the perfect place. And Tim was an amazing, he made everything so simple and easy and welcoming and wonderful. I think he said, this is a perfect match. And so we planned it.
I just can't imagine how it's going to feel with not just 7 birds, not just 17 birds, 700 birds of all species in all areas of the world and big ones and little ones.
If you haven't been in that room, you have missed something. You should come just to see it. It is phenomenal.
Have you been imagining what it might feel like to talk about solo in that situation?
I have. I'm a little nervous. I have people, friends and family coming from far away who haven't read the book yet, who are waiting. And so it's going to be amazing for me to introduce them to them, but in this place that is absolutely perfect for setting the stage.
Award-winning writer Kirsten Kaschok, who is a Pew Fellow in the Arts, a poet, a novelist, who has a background in dance. She is the author of 5 or more books of poetry, and a number of them award winners and a chapbook. And her second novel, An Impossibility of Crows, has just been issued by the University of Massachusetts Press. And there could be no more appropriate place for a book launch for An Impossibility of Crows than the Bird Gallery of the Everhart Museum in Scranton, where she will offer a talk tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock without charge. The museum is located at Naog Park, 1901 Mulberry Street in Scranton. So that's tomorrow. It's free and open to the public, but they really would love it if you would register so they will be prepared for the right number of chairs and refreshments and so forth. So to register and to learn more, it's everhart-museum.org, Everhart, everhart-museum.org. And that's at Naog Park in Scranton, tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock, free and open to the public. They request that you register, everhart-museum.org. And to find out more about the author, her website is kirstenkaschok.com, kirstenkaschok.com, kirstenkaschok.com.